I'm Michael Cathcart, and you are very, very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN, where today you'll meet the British author Geoffrey Archer, who is unapologetic about being hugely popular.
Well, if you're saying, would you rather have the Nobel Prize or 270 million readers, thank you very much, I'll have the 270 million readers.
Yeah, so that's perfectly clear. His new book is called Cometh the Hour. And you're off to Fremantle to meet the painter Anya Brock, and we talk to that very gracious American writer Jesse Ball. His new novel is about a girl who is fascinated by fire. Well, the famous American-born South African photographer Roger Ballen makes black-and-white photographs that are, well, at least to my eye, often very disturbing. You're often inside a room, there's maybe a tableau of birds, there are wires, there are people in odd positions, and they include people who gaze at us from some kind of demimonde of poverty or mental illness, places which feel dangerous to the intruder, if that's what we are, intruders. An exhibition of Roger's work opens in Sydney tomorrow, and he's also creating installations inside rooms at the old Callan Park Mental Hospital. And if you're near a computer, just search for Roger Ballen's fabulous website. Ballen is B-A-L-L-E-N. And if you click on series, you'll see the pictures that we're talking about. It's a fantastic website. Hello, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. So tell us about this latest exhibition of yours. It opens at Sydney College of Arts tomorrow. How would you describe it?
It opens this evening. Tonight's the opening, and tomorrow, I guess, is the date that the public can view the photographs and the installation that I built in the old psychiatric so-called dungeons below the college.
So these two sites are quite close to each other, aren't they?
They are, probably about 100 meters. It's part of the Sydney College of the Arts.
Yeah. So it's a retrospective?
Well, it's pictures from the last 20 years, and the title of the show is Roger Ballen's Theatre of the Mind. And the exhibition has been broken up into a couple so-called theatres, Theatre of the Absurd, Theatre of the Hidden, Theatre of the Real and the Unreal. So it's been broken up into a number of acts, series, as part of a larger exhibition.
All right. Well, let's talk about this idea of the theatre in a minute. Can we just get some background, though? You were born in New York in 1950. You moved
That's
to
correct.
Johannesburg in your 20s, and you were working as a geologist. How did that lead you into this world of photography that you now inhabit?
Well, my mother worked in Magnum in New York in the 60s and started one of the first photo galleries in the United States during that time with very famous photographers, Cartier-Bresson, Cottege, Elliot Erwitt, etc. So I got interested in photography through her when I was about 14, 15 years old. And I guess that was what kindled my interest and ultimately my passion.
And did something happen to you in South Africa that opened up this world you've been exploring for all these years?
Well, you know, when I first got to South Africa in 74, I hitchhiked from Cairo to Cape Town. And, you know, so I've been doing photography prior to that, as I said, since the mid-60s. And then I made a trip from Istanbul to New Guinea by land. I went back to America in 76 and did a PhD in geology, and then finally went back to South Africa, Johannesburg, permanently in 1982. So I've been doing photography for some time prior to going to South Africa.
I guess the first photo of yours that kind of caught my attention was a photograph of two young men who are, I guess, are twins who were disabled.
Yeah, the twins,
Dressy
and Cossie, twins, Western Transvaal,
yeah.
94.
So they're looking at the camera, they're frowning, they're maybe they're strong, maybe they're troubled, it's hard to tell. What do you say is going on here? What's going on when people like us, I guess, look at them?
Well, you see a mirror to yourself, that's all. I mean, if the picture makes you respond in some deep, profound way, it's telling you something about who you are. And so I guess that's what those pictures tell you. There's some sort of wave between you, the viewer, and those photographs, and those pictures implant themselves in your deeper part of your mind for some neurological, biological, archetypal reason. It's as simple as that. It's not necessarily about those people. It's about you.
So you feel that about yourself, do you? That this kind of reality that you photograph is in your deep psyche?
Yeah, it's in my deep psyche, and people like yourself find the work dreamlike, disturbing, whatever word you want to use, it's in your head too.
Yeah, it doesn't feel to me as though it's in my head, I must say, Roger. I feel as though I'm looking through a kind of plate glass window into another world where other people live. I feel as though I'm on this side and they're over there in the world that, you know, you enter on our behalf.
Yeah, but I'm a conduit.
You are a conduit.
I'm a conduit.
I guess.
In a way, because you're looking at the yeah. work and you're finding the work interesting, disturbing. You're making comments that show that it has had some sort of impact in your mind.
Now, that photo, which is part of a series called Platland, which, listener, you can find on Roger's website. If you just go into series, you'll see...
That's under the Platland series. That was taken in the countryside in South Africa between 86 and 94 and finalized in the book Platland.
And are these the pictures that got you into so much trouble? You ended up being arrested and getting death threats and so on in South Africa.
No, that was during the end of the apartheid era in South Africa. So this book came out in 94. And the country was in a sort of sensitive state. And a lot of people didn't, especially among the European community, didn't like the way I depicted part of the white community. It sort of opened up a wound, a sore, and they were, you know, a bit defensive about their position in society at that point. And that asked, you know, they had made the white population to into a almighty God type of essence, I guess. And this broke the balloon in a way. It wasn't the white population wasn't just that.
No, you were showing white people who were living in terrible poverty and.
Yeah, well, they were living on the edge, you know. You're walking around Sydney or work, walking around anywhere in the world, you see people living on that level. I mean, the lot people living much worse in South Africa than the pictures of the people I took. You know, the pictures really weren't about poverty. They weren't necessarily about the white community. They were more about sort of a universal concepts of being marginalized, being alienated, living on the edge. I mean, when I did the book, and after I did the book, even up to now, I said the greatest influence on that piece of work was Beckett, the playwright.
Well, if you think about Beckett, I mean, I suppose we all take different things about from Beckett, but I think of Beckett as taking into a world that has no meaning, a world from which there is no deliverance, but somehow, nevertheless, life goes on.
Well, that's exactly right. So these people were, I guess, honest about their position. They had given up trying to organize themselves, organize life. Life just passed on. Life, as Beckett said, just becomes a habit.
Mm. So your most recent series, or the most recent series I've seen, is called Asylum of the Birds. Is this Asylum of the Birds an actual place?
Yeah, there's a video I have called Asylum of the Birds. You can find it on my website or on YouTube. So it's about a 4-minute video that depicts this so-called place, which I refer to as Asylum of the Birds. Yeah, it's a place, and it's a place of Roger Bellin's mind. I mean, if you went there and took pictures for the next 1,000 years, it wouldn't be the same place as Roger Bellin's Asylum of the Birds.
I don't think I'd be brave enough to go in the door. I mean, I've looked at that video, and I wasn't clear whether you'd constructed this or it was an actual place. So it's a filthy, dark, I mean, what I would call a kind of slummy room where half-naked people are living with birds, and I mean, it just seems to come from some place of the imagination that is more elemental than language, actually.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, my photographs, I would hope, are more elemental than language. And if you can explain the pictures, they're probably not such good pictures.
Yeah, they are sort of out of reach of language.
The best pictures for me are the ones I don't actually understand.
So we're all in trouble.
Yeah, we're all in trouble. But implicitly, you understand them implicitly, but you aren't able to make a coherent statement about them.
This is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. My guest this morning is the South African photographer, Roger Bellin. So the show we're discussing, the show that's about to open in Sydney, is called Theatre of the Mind. And as you say, there are many theatres. Can you talk to me a little bit more about this concept of the theatre? What are you doing with that metaphor?
Well, each theatre, in a way, represents a part of the human condition, a part of the human experience, a part of the human enigma. So I work with the dean at the College of Arts, the Sydney College of Arts, Colin Rhodes, who was really a terrific person to work with, and he was so enthusiastic and inspired by the fact that we could work together. So it was actually his idea that we divide the exhibition into these so-called theater, and each of their particular spaces in the Sydney College of the Arts that relate to each theater or each body of work that tend to bring forth the concept like Theater of the Absurd, which was pictures I more or less took between 95 and 2002, and where the people are involved in some sort of absurd gesture to try their pass time through their lives.
I'm fascinated that you're showing at an academic institution, because my bet is that if a student proposed a series like this within an academy, it would never get past the ethics committee, because every piece of research you do in an academy has to be cleared by an ethics committee, and they're fairly severe. In fact, I think they're sort of standing in the way of free speech and open research, but that's just a little hobby horse of mine.
By the way, I never took a photography course, and probably that's why I create images the way I do.
Well, what would you say to a person on an ethics committee who says that you're exploiting these people, that they are vulnerable, that you're posing them the way you want them, that they are not really in a position to make decisions about the way you're representing them?
Yeah, I would say that person ought to be committed to an institution.
No, but seriously.
I mean, what do they know about anything about the people? The people may be my cousins, they may be my brothers, they may be my best friends. How do they know what the people themselves think? And all you have to do is open a newspaper or look at a TV program day after day after day, and whatever you accuse me of is far more exaggerated in public media. So I think it's just a way of defending a situation that of unimaginable thinking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, ethics committees often assume that the people who are being researched or represented somehow are completely powerless, that they have no will of their own. It's an extraordinary premise.
I think those people actually are powerless. They have some sort of inferiority complex in terms of what they see as powerless and powerful.
I'm glad you don't have...
This is a really a big problem in photography, and it's like a record player.
Yeah.
It doesn't get you anywhere.
No. I'm glad you don't have to appear before an ethics committee, because...
Oh, they would lose the battle.
You might alienate them.
That would be great.
We've talked a little on this show, Roger, about the anti-psychiatry of R.D. Lang. It just seems to come up from time to time. This is the idea that people who've been categorized as insane are actually just normal people reacting in the normal way to traumatic experiences or injuries. I know you studied psychiatry for a while. Does this approach to the human mind appeal to you?
The human mind is so complex, so difficult to fathom on nearly every level. I think it's the enigma of the human mind that most fascinates me, and part of what we call insane is part of the human mind. And so how the ethics committee categorizes normality and sanity is insanity itself. It's all right to authorize a group of bombers that drop bombs and bombs and bombs off on a certain country in a certain place and walk away and sleep well at night. That's okay. But taking pictures of people that have a psychological impact on your mind is not ethical. This is the world. It's just full of hypocrisy.
Yeah, you know,
the issue of normality is really a pertinent issue.
Yes,
on so many levels. We could talk all day about this.
Yeah, but in the end, does it come back to this notion of the universal mind, the idea that we somehow live on the surface? Is that the sort of metaphor you're working with, and that you're taking us into the dark place where all
the dark? Dark is repressed. Dark is what you're scared of. It's not, dark is not evil. Dark is not bad. What's wrong with the night? We're half the time in the night. So it's just a place that society fears, that society and individual can't come to terms with. And until they do, which certainly won't be in my lifetime, the problems of the humanity just will continue to expand and not improve. And that's what it's all about. And you can listen to one program on the TV or read another article, but until the human mind on a mass scale confronts itself and its own identity in a true manner, the problems can't be solved. And even if they do, it doesn't mean that the problems can't be solved.
Well, Roger, it's about...
Then we go back to Beckett again.
Well, as you always should. If you're going to go back to anywhere, go back to Beckett, because...
go back to what you're scared of.
Yeah, all right. Well, Roger, thank you for coming in.
It's a great pleasure talking to you, and I hope people can see my exhibition. It's at the Sydney College of Arts to the 30th of April. Plus, you should see the installation I made in the psychiatric so-called dungeons. This will be very something you won't forget.
Yeah, that's in the Callan Park Mental Hospital. Originally, it was called the Callan Park Hospital for the Insane, opened in 1878. So that's a very kind of confronting image. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Lovely to meet you. So that show, again, is called The Theatre of the Mind. The exhibition opens at the Sydney College of the Arts Galleries tomorrow. It runs until the end of April. All the details are there on our website, on air, online, and on your ABC radio app. You're on RN. This is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. Still to come, we have an audience with Geoffrey Archer, Lord Archer of Weston-super-Mare. Now, the Perth artist Anya Brock is well known for paintings of birds and animals. In fact, it's been a fast road to commercial success for this 32-year-old artist, with her rainbow-hued budgerigars and flamingos and zebras adorning the walls of buildings and businesses across Perth and Sydney. And they also feature, the animals I mean, on coasters and tea towels. But a recent move from the bustle of Sydney back to the relaxed environment of Fremantle has brought about a change in Anya Brock's work. She has unveiled a new series of abstracts, so a real departure. Claire Nichols is with Anya Brock at her studio in Frio.
Hi, my name is Anya Brock. I'm a visual painter, visual artist. I usually paint very bold, bright, figurative work, usually girls, animals, sometimes a bit of symmetrical geometric work. So this new stuff is a departure from that.
We're here in your studio space, which is just so fantastic. I don't think I've ever seen so much paint on the floor, ever. Can you tell me a bit about this space?
Yeah, so I've been here since 2012, the beginning of 2012. I moved to Sydney, you know, within that time, was there for about 2.5 years, but decided to keep this space. It kind of became a bit of a storage facility for me. But, I mean, it's great. There's something about this building. It's very old. Yeah, you don't have to be too precious. There's a lot of paint on the floor. I think in the beginning they said, maybe not, you know, maybe don't go crazy with paint on the floor, but it kind of just happened. But yeah, I don't know, there's something about the history of this building. I had a great space in Sydney as my studio space, but it was a new building and you had to be a little bit more careful about, you know, where the paint would go. And I think, especially for my process, I do paint very fast and I'm messy. Having the parameters of having to be neat and having to kind of stay within a space, I think definitely take effect on your work. And I think if you have that full freedom to do whatever you want and not have to worry about cleaning up or being, you know, too messy, I think that is reflective in the work. So, yeah, I love this space. And, you know, Fremantle, it's in the heart of Frio, which makes me pretty happy.
Can we talk a bit about that, the Sydney and the Fremantle thing? Yeah. How important has sense of place been for you and the creative process?
Yeah, really important. And I think it's something that, you know, you only find out through experience. And as you get older, you find out more about your own identity purely through experience. I worked in London for a little while, and I guess I wasn't painting as much in London, but I definitely felt restricted. And I guess that lack of beach, which is a huge part of my identity, was pretty hard to deal with. But then even in Sydney, you know, like I lived in Bondi and it's a very beachy kind of lifestyle, but it was just, it's so fast paced over there. And I think that's the beauty of the place. There's a lot happening and there's potential and you get kind of swept up in this energy, which I think gives you momentum for your career. And I think it definitely is, it's kind of two sides that you both, that I definitely need in my work. But actually getting anything done creatively and getting quiet enough on the inside to be able to create anything real and with true integrity, I just found very difficult over there. I felt like I was kind of on a constant level of anxiety, base level anxiety that kind of stopped me from being able to hear, you know, because all of my work is, and I think, you know, most people's artwork is all based on intuition, and it was harder to hear that intuition there. Whereas Fremantle, I think because it's my home, the survival is taken care of. So I know my friends are here, I know my family's here, I know that there's a certain base level that I don't even have to think about, so I can concentrate on the creative.
How has your work changed since you've come back?
Yeah, so it took me a little bit to get into this work. I think I've been wanting to create abstract work probably ever since I really started focusing on painting in 2010, 2011. Even before I moved to London, I did a body of abstract work, and because it's what I always looked at. I looked at all the all the abstract expressionists from the 50s, and that was what I really connected with. So I think it's been a long time coming, and I've tried to, it's been a long time in my head of trying to figure out what marks make sense to me on a personal level. And then, I don't know, I think coming back to Perth, there was just an element of my husband and I decided to have our lifestyle being be more important, you know, just be the focus rather than career for a little while. And that's what we wanted, to really support that home life. And I think with that, a connection to something real within came the work that is connected with that space as well. And just that shift away from, you know, doing, being so swayed by commerciality and being so swayed by what does sell and pushing the brand. And I think moving away from Sydney, you know, Sydney is the epicenter of making it in Australia, especially Bondi, kind of being able to be objective about that and see that was a nice, it was nice to be able to kind of go, yeah, I can see that, but I don't need to take part in it. And I think that led to just creating work that felt really real, and losing a lot of the mindset of, oh, will this, you know, be popular, or how many likes will it get, or will it sell, and all of those things that can sometimes dictate the work, the end of the process dictating the work instead of the actual process. So,
talking about those popular prints, the birds and the girls' faces, and they have been hugely successful in a very short time. Can success be a creative trap?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think it's a dance you constantly have to be self-aware about. And sometimes, I know I definitely don't feel one way all the time. Sometimes I love the fact that it gets a lot of likes and that it sells, and I love having a really great lifestyle from that. But I think it's, as long as you feel like you always have some level of objectivity and control with it, because if you feel like you're then a victim to it and you're stuck within a small space to be able to create, and you feel like there's no avenues to push through that, I think that's when it can be destructive. But often it's a cycle anyway. You go through that and then you have all of this energy to, and you this rebellious energy to bust out of it, and all of that goes into a piece or a body of work. And that, you know, it's always an action-reaction process. So then that, even though you had no intention for it to be popular or be widely received, the energy in it is so potent that, ironically, it ends up being popular because it's believable.
You're talking about Instagram and likes, which, you know, is interesting in itself. You know, the great painters of the past weren't worrying about putting their works on Instagram. Can you talk to me a little bit about how that works for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the modern day currency, really. I think it's such an incredible platform for, and I was lucky in the time that I started really concentrating on painting. I mean, any kind of visual industry benefits from it, but it's just this incredible way to get your work out there very quickly into a large audience that grows exponentially for free. And it's, you know, yes, there is a, I think there's a strategy to it, and I think there's a way to build a good Instagram account. But I guess, you know, it used to be Facebook that people would talk about this way, and I think it's just, it does become the currency at which people measure your success. They look at, you know, they find out about you, they look at how many followers you have, and then that's almost a level of, yeah, recognition of success, which, whatever, I think it's great if you can use it and not be trapped by it, but I think using it is, I mean, you're crazy not to, really, as long as you mentally manage yourself.
And don't get too obsessed with the likes.
Yeah, don't spend a lot of time checking your likes.
You've made this abstract collection a real step away from your normal work. What do you see happening next for you?
So funnily enough, it's almost like it is this action-reaction thing where I spend time on the abstract work, and then I have this craving to go back and paint girls' faces and kind of go back to figurism and also just, you know, having maybe kind of semi-accurately or at least in a stylized way reproducing something. So I've got different ideas for both. Now I kind of feel like I can run both brands, and I have another idea for some more abstract work that I want to do down the line. And then I've also got some new bodies of work that I need to put out for the two galleries that I've got. So, and then I've got some murals coming up. So yeah, I mean, it's nice because I mean, the end goal is to always be able to just come into my studio and paint exactly what I feel that day, as opposed to having any kind of schedule. But that's not necessarily the reality. So sometimes I need to trick myself into that and be aware of a schedule, but also just do, you know, work how I want to work, you know, the bodies of work that I want to do, work them into the schedule. So that's kind of the aim, rather than just trying to produce stuff that I feel that a part of me knows will sell. I want to be more strict with pushing myself with each and keep releasing new work within both brands.
The artist Anya Brock speaking to Claire Nichols in Fremantle. And you can see Anya's exhibition, which is called Detached Perspectives, at Frio's very exciting PS Art Space until the 27th of March. There are details on our website. And Anna talked about that search that she's on for that calm place where creativity happens. Be good to know if you feel that's how creativity works for you. This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Well, the British author Geoffrey Archer is one of the book world's top sellers with almost 300 million readers. That's a lot of people. His life has been almost as eventful as his very racy stories. He was an MP, he was a confidant of the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and he did time in prison for perjury. Geoffrey Archer is now 75, and he's just published his latest thriller, which is called Cometh the Hour. It's volume 6 in the Clifton Chronicles, a series which charts the rags-to-riches story of the best-selling writer Harry Clifton, who was born in the 1920s and comes right up to the present day. So he's getting pretty long in the tooth, is Harry. Like all Archer's novels, this one is packed with politics, romance and international skullduggery, and there are a fair few overlaps with his own topsy-turvy life. He's talking to Fiona Gruber.
I must say, first of all, congratulations on being top of the bestseller lists in Australia, the UK, the US, India.
Everywhere, yeah.
Everywhere.
It's wonderful.
Well, I know it's right. I mean, I know you must be used to it by now, but do you still get nervous about the reception of your books?
It's not common to be number one in America, London and Australia at the same time. No, that's not common.
No, that is pretty special. But do you get butterflies about the reception?
You can't take the public for granted. I always try to make the latest book better than the last one. But the public may change their mind. They may like someone else.
Well, you do finish every book on a cliffhanger of quite stupendous proportions. So we're now at volume 6 of your Clifton Chronicles about the life and adventures of Harry Clifton. It was only supposed to be 5 volumes. Did too much happen to him to contain him? Did he get away from you?
Well, the problem was, you're quite right, Fiona, I had originally intended it to be 5 volumes. But at the end of the 5th volume, Harry was only 42, Emma was only 40, Giles was only 42, and I couldn't kill them all off in their 40s. So I went back to the publisher and said, it's going to take me 7 volumes, and they thought that was fine. And so I just got on with it, and that was good because the story was there, the story was flowing, so that wasn't a problem for me.
Well, I can't imagine that publishers would go, no, Geoffrey, we've had enough of you. they look at their bank balance. So let's tell the story of Harry Clifton briefly for those people who haven't read volumes 1 to 5. Who
sure.
is Harry Clifton?
Harry Clifton comes from Bristol in the West Country of England. He's the son of a docker. And he wins a scholarship to Bristol Grammar School and falls in love with a young girl whose father owns the docks. And for reasons I will not tell you, does not want Harry Clifton to marry his daughter. And the first book, Only Time Will Tell, and you really should start at the beginning, but for several reasons, not least, you can buy the first book in paperback, and therefore if you don't like it, you don't have to bother with the second or the latest. But it takes the life of Harry Clifton and Emma Clifton and Giles Barrington, Emma's brother, right the way through from 1920 almost up to the 21st century. And we're now on the sixth book, and I've one more to go, and that will come out in November.
You are incredibly prolific. The fact that you've just published one and you published the last one a couple of years ago. When we spoke to you, I think in 2012, you were only on volume two. How come you're so prolific? Are you very disciplined? Are you the enemy of procrastination?
The stories are always there, Fiona. They never stop. I'm very, very lucky. They just keep flowing.
Well, you are very lucky. I mean, I speak to so many writers who get writer's block on a regular basis, and you don't seem to at all.
Well, I've great sympathy with them, and I do understand the problem, but I would have to say in all honesty, no, I have never had writer's block. I confess that I don't know where the damn book is going or what is going to happen, but no, I've never had writer's block.
Now, with this one, we're now at the beginning of the 1970s, the era of the Cold War, the rise of Margaret Thatcher, who became Prime Minister of Britain, and she's got quite a big, more than a walk-on part in this. So what's going on in this volume? It's your era, isn't it? It's the era of the rise of Geoffrey Archer.
Well, it was nice to write about Margaret Thatcher, who, of course, I had the privilege and honour of knowing well, and bringing her into the book and making her a friend of Emma's so that she actually changes Emma's whole life. And in the final book, she's even bigger. So she gets, as you quite rightly say, Fiona, a walk-on part in this book, in Cometh the Hour. But in the final book, she plays a very large part.
So when you wrote this volume, you already knew what was going to happen in the final volume, did you?
No, hadn't got a clue. I thought Margaret would get bigger. Yes, I admit that. And I knew it had to be the last volume. The last thing I needed was for people to say, is there going to be another one? So I knew that much. But outside of that, no, I did not, and just crossed my fingers and hoped, and it never stopped. I got very lucky.
Well, you do paint Margaret Thatcher as a very charismatic and amusing woman. Was she like that? I presume she was, and you had a very close relationship.
She was great company, not least because she just didn't have time to waste talking about irrelevant things. She was always fascinating. She was always wanting to learn or wanting to debate.
I have to confess that my favourite character in the novels is the dastardly Lady Virginia Fenwick.
You and everyone love the wicked Lady Fiona, and she is.
No, you just
wicked.
Said Lady Fiona. I love that slip, but you meant Lady Virginia.
And the men love her too, despite the fact of what she gets up to.
Well, I know. Well, maybe it's men who really like being stomped on, because she is a stomper in sort of almost literally, isn't she? But she absolutely screws men over left, right and centre. And women, of course, she's very vengeful, isn't she?
Oh, she doesn't care who she defeats or treads on top of. But she may get her comeuppance in the final book.
Look, I'm expecting her to kind of drown in some quagmire somewhere, you know, with bubbles rising to the surface. Because I did see an interview that you recorded where you said that you actually did plan to kill her off in the last volume, and that she just wouldn't die. She just kept on coming back. So are you not in control of your characters?
No, you're not. You're referring quite rightly to the libel scene where I got up that morning and said, this is a real chance to kill her off. I'll have the QC flatten her. And when I got out of bed and went to my room and wrote the first sentence, she just batted him off. So I thought, oh, well, I better go on. Wrote the second sentence, which I thought would flatten her. Out came a sentence that flattened him. And she did this until he was broken and she had won. And I thought, well, that wasn't what I planned this morning. But that's how it's gone. So she's still there in the sixth book, and she'll still be there in the seventh book, wicked woman.
You obviously really love her too.
I'm quite right. I adore her.
Well, this is your most personal of all the volumes, I would imagine, because, as I was saying, it's your decade where you first became a Conservative Member of Parliament and then famously almost went bankrupt, so got yourself out of a hole by writing a novel, Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, which became a huge bestseller and made you pots of money and launched your writing career.
Yes, I again got lucky, because if I knew then what I know now, is that for every 1,000 books that are presented to a publisher, only one gets published. and that for every 1,000 that get published, only one makes it onto the bestsellers list. And for every 1,000 that make it onto the bestsellers list, only one gets the number one. So yes, it was an amazing turn in the sense that wasn't what I'd planned to do with my career. But that's how it ended up, and I've been very, very privileged and very lucky.
And obviously you're a bestseller. Do you get concerned when, critics dismiss your work as potboilers, or does it bother you that that bestseller seems to equate with not at the top of the literary tree?
Well, if you're saying, would you rather have the Nobel Prize or 270 million readers, thank you very much, I'll have the 270 million readers. But frankly, lately, the critics have been very generous. So it's taken me 30 years to get them to do it, but they've been a lot better recently.
Now, there does seem to be a fair bit of overlap between the characters of Harry Clifton and Sir Giles Barrington and your own character. You know, Harry Clifton's a successful novelist, and Sir Giles has been a member of the House of Commons and then becomes a member of the House of Lords, like you, and you're now Baron Archer of Weston-super-Mare. You're a member of the House of Lords as well. And Emma Clifton is quite similar in certain respects to your wife, Lady Mary Archer. Are these intentional, or is this just another aspect of your subconscious taking control?
There's a lot of Harry in me. You're quite right. There's a bit of Giles in me. You're quite right. And Emma is unquestionably my distinguished wife. And I always say to young authors, write about what you know about, and then the reader will know that it's authentic and feels right. Don't write a ghost story because ghost stories are in. Don't write a sex story because sex stories are in. Write what you feel relaxed with. Never forget Jane Austen only wrote about a small village in England and captured the hearts of the entire British nation.
Well, that does suggest that you have had a much more adventurous life than Jane Austen, of course, because you're writing about the Cold War and East Germany and the Stasi. You're talking about the banking world in the City of London and high finance. You're talking about American Texan oil millionaires. You get around. You have had a very adventurous life. You've had your ups. You've had your downs with time in prison, etc., which, of course, you then... The man with the most chutzpah, you turned that into a great success with your prison diaries. And also, you spoke so candidly about how that taught you lessons about the disadvantaged people who end up in prison.
Yes, I've always considered I had a very privileged life and a very lucky life. And you're absolutely right. A period in prison taught me just how lucky I had been. And I suppose the greatest piece of luck was that I could return and go on writing novels, go on writing my stories. And the British people, indeed, all over the world, stuck by me, and I'm now selling more books than I've ever sold before.
Have you ever been tempted by your success? I mean, you've tried politics, of course, but do you sometimes get megalomaniac tendencies ever?
Well, I think I consider myself lucky. I might have had a more important political career, but I didn't. As a politician, I failed in those terms. Where I was very lucky is I had the writing to fall back on. And for the last 15 years, I've only been writing. I've kept my interest in politics, fascination with it, but I've not held any job or done anything. So my entire energy has been spent on writing the books.
Though I am fascinated that, you obviously keep your hand in, and in this novel, we're right at the beginning of Britain's involvement in the European common market. And here we are, 40-odd years later, with Britain possibly, in a few months' time, on the brink of leaving the European Union. So, I mean, what do you think of that?
You're quite right. The British are going through a traumatic period, in particular the Conservative Party, which is very split on Europe. I'm of an open mind, but if I had to vote today, I would be staying in.
Personally speaking, I'm glad to hear it. But it's a very difficult subject, obviously. So you do a lot of research for your books.
You have to, but of course, as you rightly say, I've led an interesting life and met a lot of interesting people. So one is able to pass on, one is able to use incidents, experiences, things that have happened in one's own life, and you'll see them coming out in the Clifton Chronicles.
Now you've written the final volume you must be feeling rather torn. You must feel as though a large cache of your family are about to sort of be wiped out or something. You must be feeling rather bereft.
Yes, you're right. After 7 volumes in 7 years, which I've literally remained focused on and dedicated to for that period of time, I am going to be bereft. But don't worry, Fiona, I have other ideas for other novels, which you will be hearing about.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Goodness me, on RN, the irrepressible Geoffrey Archer, Baron Archer of Western Supermare, talking about his latest novel and lots of other things. The latest one's called Cometh the Hour, and it's part 6 in the Clifton Chronicles, and it's published by Pan Macmillan. Fiona Gruber with that story. Next up, cometh an author who plays with fire.
Hello, it's Norman Swan here. This week on the Health Report, the extent of care that's carried out in the Australian healthcare system that people just don't want.
This is called advanced care planning, but it's not rocket science. It's simply training staff to sit down and talk to patients in the same way they'd want to be talked to if it was them.
Advanced care planning, just one of the stories, this week on the Health Report. This Monday afternoon and Tuesday morning at 5:30, here on RN.
And on RN, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. Well, he's under 40, but Jesse Ball already has 6 novels to his name, and his new one is called How to Set a Fire and Why. It's told from the viewpoint of a 14-year-old girl called Lucia. Like many teenagers, she feels angry and alienated from the adult world around her. But Lucia does have some cause to feel isolated. Her mum is in an asylum, and her dad is dead. And all that she has left of him is his Zippo lighter, and that comes to play a very important part in this story. Sarah Konofsky is speaking with Jesse Ball at Avid Reader Bookshop in Brisbane, and he kicks off with a reading. There's some strong language in this one, I should say. So where is Lucia when this scene happens?
She's like dragged in before this psychologist in her school. And the psychologist kind of believes that she has some vapid wisdom to bestow, but she gets it kind of cast in her face. It revolves around a poem by Rumi. Okay. I guess this was the principal's revenge. Since he couldn't give me the detention without my aunt flogging him, he notified the psychologist that she should check up on me. I want to see how you're settling in, she told me. I sat down in her office and was immediately really unhappy. This is how it is. There are no chairs. I kid you not, there are 2 beanbags. She sits on a beanbag, and you sit on the other, or if you want, you both sit on the floor, I guess. Sometimes she does this thing where she switches from the beanbag to the floor, like some kind of conciliatory gesture. The beanbags are different colors, and I'm sure it means something to her which one you choose. Thinking that made me hesitant to sit before her, so I let her sit first, but I'm sure that means something too. She's really young, Miss Kaplow, and extremely beautiful, which is why all the male teachers do boss stuff when she is in the hall, like clapping each other on the shoulder and leaning on things. Even the students do. On this visit, she was wearing an inappropriate skirt. It was fine as skirts go, but miniskirts and beanbag chairs are not a match made in heaven. I told her I was fine. I was going to try to make it for 2 more years and then be done. If I couldn't do that, I would leave, since I legally don't have to stay any longer. What is keeping you here? She asked. I said I didn't want to disappoint my aunt. She asked me if I loved my aunt. I didn't answer that. What bullshit, where they use whatever you say to make further questions. Then she asked if I was angry. I said that anyone who loves freedom should be angry. That shut her up. We sat there for a while, and then she said she wanted to read me something. She got some shitty poem by Rumi and read it to me. There is a candle in your heart. I laughed, and she asked me why I was laughing. I said, you small-minded bitch, you think that's poetry? Of all Rumi's goddamn poems, you picked that one? Did you find it in some psych nonsense anthology? That has to be his worst poem, and it isn't even translated well. How does it feel like to wait around in life so hopelessly? You're just mired in shit. You're so limited. I laughed some more. Of all the poems, that one. She was looking at me in shock. I think she was actually speechless, so I gave her some more. Whoever is calm and sensible is insane. What? I said, that's Rumi. Or didn't you know? I didn't feel at all bad that I made her cry. After all, a school psychologist probably has to cry a lot in the first years of working at a school. There must be a great deal they aren't ready for. So she behaves in this way. But then she goes home. Well, I got in trouble for that. When I got home, I told my aunt the whole story about the beanbags, the Rumi poem, everything. I did it because I felt like I had broken the rules. I wasn't proud of being mean to her. When I'm not proud of what I've done, I tell my aunt about it. I used to tell my dad, now I tell my aunt. I'm sure it gives her a picture of me that's pretty unflattering, since I tell her all the bad things, but none of the good ones. She asked me if I thought it was my job to improve the school psychologist. I said no. She asked if I thought of myself as a person who goes around improving other people by showing them their shortcomings. I said no, I wasn't that sort of person. She said it was puzzling then why I would say that to the woman. Wasn't I trying to improve her? There was another explanation. Maybe I just wanted to demonstrate to the woman that I was smarter than she was. Maybe I was showing off. I said maybe it was that. She said if that was true, it meant I must feel weak and ashamed if I need to demonstrate my intelligence rather than just having it. She said that quietly and then turned away to make some tea. Boy, did I feel awful. My aunt, when she gives it to you, she really gives it to you. When she brought the tea over, she said, "It's possible my comprehension was not of the really good sort, but just a mean sort of proto-intelligence, and that was why I was being mean. Maybe I was embarrassed about its quality and magnitude, and that led me to go after these low-hanging fruit." I could see the corner of her mouth was turning, so I burst out laughing, and she laughed too. It was a good joke. So that's kind of the process between the aunt and the...
Yeah, it's a lovely illustration of their relationship. And I also think of the fact that Lucia has this intelligence, a really fierce intelligence, and it's a very particular kind of teenage sort of intelligence that she doesn't yet have the emotional maturity to know really how to deal with it. You know, she uses it to push people away while she's desperately wanting to make connections.
And also because you don't always know what's hurt you, you know? Sometimes suddenly something else happens and you feel the hurt, so you try to get revenge on the wrong party, you know?
So all she has left from her dad, who's died, is this Zippo lighter. And this starts her obsession with fire. What does she love about fire?
The thing that's really attractive about fire fire is its own creature. You begin it, and then you don't have to keep adding to it. It continues of its own accord and grows and grows. And so if you're a child and you're perhaps in some ways weak, you realize you can't lift a house up off its foundations. You can hardly lift even one rock or brick, but if you set fire to something, it's a great ally.
She thinks a lot about the ethics of fire and of lighting fires. What does she think about the ethics of fire?
Well, in particular, one of the reasons why I think in the law code you're so punished for arson is because the sort of disgusting integument that holds together our civilization is often property and ownership of property, and fire is the direct enemy of property. It destroys. It doesn't see that this particular house is owned by a wealthy person and this house is owned by no one. It just burns everywhere, you know. And so it's quite wonderful.
She thinks, though, about what it might mean if someone's in one of those houses that gets burnt.
She's tender-hearted, yeah. In the book, she writes a sort of screed. Actually, there's an arson club that she wants to join, and when she goes to join it, there's some materials that have been written already, and she feels that maybe those materials are a little too masculine, written by a man and for men, so she alters and writes her own.
I think the passage that you read, Jesse, is a really great example of the voice that she has as a teenager. And as I was reading this book, I kept thinking of the other teenage voices in fiction. And I wondered, out of that history of books, which ones do you think work well? Are there examples that you like as a reader?
It's hard to say. I mean, there are the really, really large ones like great, great characters like Huck Finn or Tom Sawyer or Holden Caulfield. But I think aiming for a characterization like that will never hit the mark. Instead, the main thing is just to attempt in the prose the greatest gentleness that you can to try to evoke the finest distinctions. And that leads to the voice. Just feeling as I do as this character, what is the thing that she would say and wouldn't say in the most precise sense.
I could be wrong, but it sort of struck me that the way she talks and thinks to herself is partly informed by the books that she says she loves and the reading that you imagine she would be doing. And I think that's part of what's happening in that teenage, in those teenage years, is this creation of a sensibility that, yeah, partly comes out of your own experience, but is also fed by the books you're reading, the films you're watching. And so sometimes when I felt, gee, she sounds like Holden Caulfield here, for example, I thought, but maybe that's exactly how teenagers do sound, because they're reading that stuff and they're using those sort of phrases.
And she's also a book snob.
Yeah. Well, more than just a book snob, you did this very deftly, is that in this world, like, she doesn't like high school, she doesn't really have that many connections with her peers, all she's got left in her family is her aunt, is these books and films and music, they're like lighthouse beams, you know, she can kind of see a way out when she connects with a book.
Well, she believes in the intellectual traditions of mankind, just unintellectualized and certainly taken outside of institutions. She feels completely comfortable reducing those institutions to dust, but keeping the actual true knowledge that is there.
One of the other characters that comes into her life is this high school teacher who wants to offer her a way out and wants her to get into a different program and get into college. And that's a whole trope in teenage fiction, is the good English teacher who is the lifeline for the gifted but troubled student. But this book doesn't follow the script of what's meant to then happen with that lifeline.
I think, at least in the United States, there's a myth that you can actually lift yourself up by your bootstraps out of circumstances, and that personal excellence is sufficient, maybe not always sufficient, but sometimes sufficient. And in fact, I think that talent and open-heartedness often just directly lead to you being abjectly crushed and destroyed, and you don't rise out of your circumstances, you know, and I think it's just the case. So most of my books end sadly.
Josie, I mean, I am worried about her future. You know, she says herself that she's snowblind looking into her future. So you don't give us a happy resolution where she gets into Yale and it all works out. But where is she going?
Well, once my mother didn't like the end of a book that I had written. And so as a present, I wrote her a different end, which is she wasn't allowed to show anyone. It was just for her. You know. So we'll see, maybe, you know.
I think you should offer them, like, in an envelope at the back of your books. There should be the alternate happy ending for characters you've come to feel great affection for.
It just costs more. It costs more.
Well, we'll talk to text about maybe doing that. Well, all it leaves for us to do is thank Jessie Ball very much.
Or maybe you pay extra for alternative endings. You know, you keep investing $2 or $3 till you find an ending you like. Sarah Konoski speaking to Jessie Ball there at the Avid Reader bookstore in Brisbane about his latest novel, which is called How to Set a Fire and Why. And that one, as Sarah said, is published by text. Well, thanks for your company here on this RN podcast. We make the show every weekday, and on Saturdays we bring you a showcase of the week's highlights. So I hope you'll join us again when we bring you the best in fiction, performance and visual arts here on Books and Arts. And if you'd enjoyed the show, do let us know on our website. Let's talk again soon. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Bye-bye.